public hearing on Bill 2299 and 2300 and ask Scott Sideris. Excuse me if I mispronounced your name.
Of course.
Chair, Representative Merkley, my name is Scott Sideris. I'm the presiding magistrate of the Oregon Tax Court. Thank you for this opportunity to call your attention to House Bill 2299. I've prepared some brief testimony as to this bill. There, frankly, is not a lot to it. The Magistrate Division of the Oregon Tax Court was created by the 1995 legislature. It was funded for the 1997-99 biennium. The first full year of the court's operation was the 1998 tax year. We found in that year that if we made some relatively minor changes in the statutes, we could operate as a more efficient court and also give more guidance to participants as to exactly how they can make use of the Oregon Tax Court. These changes are set out in House Bill 2299.
Okay, do you want to describe what the changes are?
Certainly. They're relatively minor. The first group of changes appear in Section 1, and that deals with the substitution of entry of a written decision for mailing. What we found is the volume of appeals with the Magistrate Division is extremely high. We have 3,200 appeals. That number in itself is rather deceptive because the appeal will include a number of subsets within it. And when we mail out such a high volume, we don't know when exactly each written decision is mailed. We find, however, that we know when each decision is entered into the official records of the Oregon Judicial Department. And so when we have entry substitute for mailing, we cut down on the demands put on our clerks, which are very substantial with the limited staffing of our court. Another group of more substantial changes appears later where we turn to such parts as Section 4, Section 6, Section 9, Section 8, 9, 10, all through the rest of the bill. We see specific mention made of regular division of the Oregon Tax Court. That's because Measure 50, like Measure 5, allows litigants to challenge taxes, fees, and assessments. If we don't insert such specific language, there is a very strong probability that litigants challenging a fee, tax, or assessment would first have to file with the Magistrate Division, get a decision from the magistrate, appeal on to the regular division, get a decision of the judge, then appeal to the Supreme Court before a tax fee or assessment could be settled. It's very important to local counties that their tax fees and assessments be settled as soon as possible. It struck the tax court it would be a good idea to allow a more expedited process to get such matters immediately before the judge without any controversy.
Okay. And who was the author of the changes suggested in here?
They all come from the tax court. We've talked with the litigants who come before the court, and they have no problem with the bill. In fact, we're pleased with the changes made.
And in your opinion, has the creation of the tax court been successful and responsive to the public?
Representative Chair Strobeck, I can talk about that for so long that it will cause ill feelings with my enthusiasm. I'll reduce it to a one-word answer, very.
Thank you very much. Okay, we also have 2300 open if you want to address your comments on that bill as well.
I will. Chair Strobeck, members of the committee, 2300 is an entirely different piece of legislation than the one I talked about before. House Bill 2300 gives expanded appeal rights to a specific group of litigants. And again, I've prepared some testimony as to House Bill 2300 that summarizes the situation. What we deal with House Bill 2300 is a specific group of taxpayers, those who pay income tax. And we're dealing with, within that group, those who do not promptly appeal the decisions of the Department of Revenue. there are a variety of reasons why the Department of Revenue will go after taxpayers to achieve taxes due. Either individuals do not file a return and do not report income and do not pay the tax, or they file a return with which the agency disagrees. The agency takes its action and issues an assessment and sends out notice to that person at their last known address. When that person gets the notice, there are a number of things that can happen. What we hope happens is they read that notice very carefully and within the 90 days specified come to the tax court to explain to the tax court whether or not they owe the tax. Not everyone does that. Significant group of litigants runs into the problem of not understanding the particular importance of taking action now. I have had individuals tell me that the reason they did not file an appeal is they were too afraid. They thought that when they opened the envelope, they would find out they would go to jail. In other cases, what happens is individuals just don't know within 90 days of the department's action that the agency is issuing an assessment against them. An example would be an individual who moved. Obviously, we think of putting forth a change of address, but not everyone notifies the department that they're moving. Many think that when they file the return, they'll give notice of the change of address, or the post office will automatically forward. That does not always happen, and so the court has had to deal with the situation of a taxpayer explaining, I just didn't know within 90 days that the department was taking action against me. Another instance is individuals will get the notice but not act within the 90 days because of unique circumstances. The situation that the court has dealt with is an individual who has the notice of assessment actually received at their household. A visiting family member took it, recognized it was extremely important, and put it in a safe place. Unfortunately, then forgot about it till after the 90 days. Another situation that we run into at times is an instance where an individual was fleeing an abusive spouse, deliberately did not give notice of their address to any agency. The Department of Revenue took action because income tax returns were not paid. In all these situations, those who were too frightened to respond, those who did not keep the department informed of their address, those who lost or misplaced the notice, those who thought they had a good reason for not responding to the notice, in all those cases, the tax court was faced with the hard result of saying, look, it doesn't matter what the correct amount of tax is. It does not matter how much you actually owe. The tax court cannot hear your appeal. The assessment stands. House Bill 2300 acts to remedy that situation by giving an expanded appeal right that if you pay the tax, you have 2 years to file an appeal and seek a refund of any excess taxes paid. Now, this particular unique solution is not one that the tax court came out with out of whole cloth. This is a procedure followed by the federal system. What worked with the federal government seems a good idea for Oregon. The tax court proposes it as a solution.
Okay. Thank you very much for bringing these bills forward, Mr. Federa. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman? I'd like to go back to your first bill, 2299. And first of all, I'd like to say that 2300 sounds to me, if I understand it correctly, excellent in expanding the appeal opportunities for individuals and reducing the conflicts that you've noticed. Back to 2299 on the first page, line 25, where you have a party dissatisfied with a written decision, within 60 days after the date of entry of the written decision. I'm assuming the reason it said mailing previously was because it then tied it to notification of the party, whereas entry is something that occurs within the court apart from notification of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we be confident that the party, there's probably other provisions that provide for notification, but how are entry of the decision and notification of the party connected?
Okay. Pretty Chair Strobeck, Representative Merkley, we've done the best we can to make that pretty clear. And so what happens when you receive a decision at the court is at the very bottom, there's a date line next to the signature line, and that date line is a specific date of entry. And that gives notice to the parties that's the trigger date for the 60 days. Everyone knows that that's the trigger date. You calculate the 60-day appeal period from. The specific problem that we had with the mailing date is the court doesn't know when the postmark actually gets put on the envelope. We can find out when we put it in the mailroom, and we can find out maybe when it's delivered into the hands of the Postal Service. But the parties, when they receive the envelope, can look and see the postmark, but we don't know that. And so it's less controversial if there's one clear set date everybody knows that we figure the 60 days from.
Okay. And it appears that the law in the line 21 requires mailing to the parties, although it doesn't require mailing within a certain time period. It doesn't appear.
Do you have another question?
Am I correct in believing that there's nothing that ties in the notification of the parties in terms of the time that the court has to notify them in this legislation, in the law?
Chair Strobeck, Representative Merkley, that's exactly right. And the reason for that is each case has to be flexibly decided. The litigation that will come before the court is very diverse. On the one hand, we may be dealing with the value of a silicon wafer manufacturing plant. In another, we'll be dealing with the value of a modest house. In each case, the court has to reach a written decision, but there's no timeline set out in the statute that says from the time of the filing of an appeal, from the time of trial, from the time the record closes within so many days, the magistrate must make a decision. No, that is not the case, sir.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I would just express a question as to whether it would protect parties if we take away mailing out of line 25, should we also then in some way note that the mailing of the decision to the parties needs to occur within a certain number of days of entry or within a certain number of days in which the written decision is completed or something of that nature? I just pose that as a question.
Chair Strobeck, Representative Merkley, certainly you can do that. I can't offhand suggest an appropriate limit. 2 days, 1 day, 3 days, 5 days. We certainly have every incentive to get a decision out as soon as possible. It's been signed by the magistrate. The magistrate wants to make that decision, resolve the case. And so it's our practice within a minimal time to get it out. And I certainly can't imagine how we could work much faster.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Sedaris, how many, or what is the caseload annual, some sort of a estimate?
Certainly. During calendar year 1998, Chair Strobeck, we had some 3,200 appeals filed. Those deal with appeals as to every Oregon tax. Of course, the largest two groups are the personal income tax, property tax, but in all, we had appeals as to more than a dozen different tax programs. The largest case before the magistrate division involves more than $12 million in tax, and then it goes down to, of course, the more modest case.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. These bills will work for a work session on Friday.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else here to speak on either one of these two bills? If not, public hearing on House Bill 2299 and 2300. and open a public hearing on House Bill 2190. Dick, will you tell us what 2190 is?
Morning, Mr. Mayor. 2190 deals with collection of fuel taxes, delinquent fuel taxes. The situation basically now is that the statutes provide for the Attorney General to prosecute in cases where tax due is not paid. Practically what the Department of Transportation does is to assign those accounts over to the Department of Revenue for collection. And the purpose here of the first part of the bill is essentially to allow the department to use the language which is similar to that which exists for the weight mile taxes and make that apply to the fuel taxes so that they can use essentially the professional staff that they have with respect to auditing fuel tax motor vehicle accounts to audit the fuel taxes. So you get, like Eastern and Western severance tax, you get kind of a repeat here for two different taxes. One is the gasoline tax, essentially, which is in the first part of Chapter 319, and then what's called the use fuel tax, which starts at 319.540, I think it is, which applies to diesel fuel and then propane and natural gas that's used to propel automobiles. Anyway, in Section 2, then, you have the authority to give the department essentially the authority to issue warrants and to follow essentially collection procedures, which are similar to those that exist for the weight mile tax. It gives them, in Section 3, authority to use a collection agent or assign accounts to a collection agent. Provides in Section 4 for uncollectible accounts after 3 years of signing those to the Secretary of State. Then in Sections 5 and 6, you're repealing the existing language, and you can see in line 34 there the reference to the Attorney General, which is the current authority on page 2, and also again line 13 of page 3. Section 7, then, is just a reference change. And then beginning in Section 9, you have a repeat of that language as it applies to the use fuel tax. On page 4, then, Section 12, there's an increase in the required bond, currently twice the estimated monthly license tax up to a maximum of $100,000. This has changed to four times up to a maximum of $1 million. It also adds on line 41 of page 4 the authority or it grants the licensee essentially the right to a hearing with regard to both whether a bond should be imposed and secondly whether the amount's too high. Section 13 deals with the department's ability to waive the penalty, which is provided in that previous section. You will have, and it's in council, I don't have it for you this morning, you will have an amendment from Representative Loken, which asks that to be retroactive back to January 1 of 98. Just briefly, the problem that's involved here is with the use fuel tax, you have card lock service stations essentially without attendance, and under the law they are basically not sellers. So they're not required to collect the tax. And they have been, or some of them have been, sort of gathering groups of people together to basically become a large supply unit. But as it turns out, each one of those individuals should, under the law, now get a user's license because they're not buying tax fuel. And they should then report and pay the tax to the department. Well, needless to say, this is a problem in terms of making it work out. And so that's what the waiver is concerned, the retroactive waiver when it comes to it. I'll have that amendment on Friday to address that problem. In subsection 4, line 28 of page 5, you have language which makes the willful failure to file a Class C felony, essentially. It moves it down into subsection 2 at line 38, where that section is added. Makes it a theft of public property. Then you have some new authority in section 17 for the gasoline tax and in section 20 for the used fuel tax, which allows the department to refuse to issue a license where an individual has been guilty, essentially, of defrauding the state in other situations or other states with respect to fuel taxes. And then the parallel change with that, if you look on page 7, line 15, you simply change shall to may. So the department does not have to issue the license. It may issue the license, and these are the conditions then in section 17 under which it may refuse to issue the license.
Okay. Quinton Hess and Dave Tyler.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dave Tyler. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for ODOT. With me is Quinton Hess, who is the manager of Fuel Tax Group. We are here in support of this bill. Mr. Yates did an excellent job of summarizing everything, but I think Mr. Hess would probably like to make a few comments concerning some of the background and why we requested this concept be submitted for your consideration.
Okay.
Chairman Strobeck, members of the committee. My name is Quinton Hess. I'm the manager of the Fuel Tax Group for ODOT. House Bill 2190 does basically four things. It revises the procedures for collecting delinquent fuel taxes. It increases the amount of bond required by motor vehicle fuel dealers. And it allows a retroactive waiver of the 25% penalty for unauthorized use of used fuel. And finally, specified grounds for refusal to issue certain licenses. And Mr. Yates has done a very nice job of summarizing my testimony for me, but I will go ahead and go through it again. For starters, Oregon's fuel taxes are levied against two types of fuels. The first is motor vehicle fuel, and that includes gasoline and aircraft tax. The second category is used fuel, and that's primarily diesel, compressed natural gas, CNG, propane. Licensed dealers may import or export or otherwise handle motor vehicle fuel as long as they're licensed with ODOT. People who sell used fuel have to be licensed with us if they sell it for use in a motor vehicle. And people who use used fuel and don't pay the tax at the time they purchase the fuel at the pump have to be licensed with us as users of fuel. The first section, collection, in sections 1 through 11, the amendments are made to change existing collection powers to allow ODOT to collect delinquent fuel taxes in the same way it collects the weight mile tax. Currently, we perform limited collection in bankruptcy duties in my unit before we transfer them over to the Department of Revenue. It would be more efficient to take advantage of the existing expertise at ODOT in the collection area. These employees are trained and experienced in collection practices, techniques, and the legal intricacies of bankruptcy. We estimate at a cost of about half an FTE, $34,599 in a biennium, that we could collect an additional revenues of $70,000.
Mr. Hess, do you use the Attorney General now, as the current statute indicates?
Primarily, we've used the Department of Revenue. We use the Attorney General in some cases, but our normal practice is just to send it over to the Department of Revenue.
So if this bill passes, would you expect any reduction in the budget for legal costs that would normally be part of the Department of
Justice.
Chairman Sobeck, yes, I would expect a small amount. The collection unit uses the Attorney General's office as well for advice. The next section deals with the bonding. Section 12 increases bonding limits for motor vehicle fuel dealers two times the monthly tax liability with a maximum bond of $100,000, four times monthly tax liability with a maximum of $1 million. In 1967, the last time the bond section was amended, ODOT collected over $56 million in fuel taxes at a tax rate of 7 cents a gallon. In 1998, ODOT collected over $370 million at a tax rate of 24 cents a gallon. The maximum bond limitation of $100,000 for motor vehicle fuel dealers inadequately protects the state from losses due to failure to pay or bankruptcy. In 1998, 61 of the 200 motor vehicle fuel dealers that are currently licensed reported average monthly tax liabilities in excess of $100,000 a month. Motor vehicle fuel taxes are not due until the month following the sale of the fuel. Dealers can easily owe in excess of $200,000 before we're even aware of a payment problem. A recent non-payment in excess of $300,000 due to a bankruptcy could have been eliminated if bond limits were higher. The increase to four times a month liability with $1 million maximum will substantially decrease the number of companies that are underbonded. The next section, Section 13, penalty, addresses the waiver of a 25% penalty imposed under ORS 319.611 for the unlicensed use of used fuel. Most other penalties under Chapter 319 can be waived administratively. The criteria included the violation was due to reasonable cause and without any intent to avoid payment. This amendment would allow administrative waiver of the 25% penalty and we determined the violation was due to reasonable cause and without any intent to avoid payment. At the request of Representative Loken, we're proposing the effective date of the authority to waive the penalty be retroactive, January 1, 1998. And the reason for this is because over 2,000 diesel vehicle owners got involved with a car lock operation that advertised misleading information about the tax status of the fuel purchases. Oregon tax is not included in the price of the fuel. This amendment would allow ODOT to retroactively waive the 25% penalty for those people who incurred a tax liability through no fault of their own.
Mr. Hess, maybe I could ask you to just hold up there just for a second since Representative Loken has come to the hearing room. And is this the section that you want, or are you here to talk about this?
To support this amendment.
Okay, why don't you come on up to the table here and get it on the record.
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you. Go ahead. You just talked about your request regarding this waiver.
All right, so thank you. We have a letter from the DeBalls. We did receive a letter explaining the situation that they encountered and through this card lock operation, and
I guess we don't have that before us, Representative Loken, but we'll get some copies when we get to the
discussion. And I'm Jane Loken, State Representative, District 25, for the record. But I am proposing and I've discussed this with ODOT, that those penalties be waived because they were told in this card lock operation that they would that the taxes for their purchases of fuel were included in the purchase price. Lo and behold, they get their billing, and it was not. And they had started, they had joined this group about 10, 11 months prior to that, and that was the first time they knew that their taxes were not included in their in the billings and for their gasoline. So they were not the only ones. I understand there were about 2,000 purchasers who encountered the same problem. So they are asking that those penalties, they are willing to, of course, to pay the tax, but they are asking that the penalties be waived. They'd certainly like to have the interest waived, too. But that is what I am hoping that the committee will be favorable to do and accept at the moment.
Okay, thank you, Representative Logan. Do you know if the ODOT has spoken in support of your amendment? I think the committee is probably favorably inclined. I guess the one question I would have, we do have a copy of the letter now here, too, that says we never intended to avoid paying taxes or to purchase fuel illegally. However, if I were going to a card lock and everybody around me was selling gas for, I don't know, back in March or February or April, it was, you know, 99 cents for a gallon of regular, and if I was buying it for 76 cents at a card lock station, I would think there was something a little out of whack. I would expect a penny or two savings, but not the entire 24 cents of tax. So these people must have thought they were getting quite a deal at the card lock station.
Well, I'm sure they did, and I was looking for the advertisement that showed and absolutely stated that the taxes were included in this. And they did investigate this through the Better Business Bureau in two states, and they really went to quite an extent to verify that the taxes, that this was a bona fide arrangement. So it was very surprising to find that it was not.
Sort of like getting a property tax bill and assuming that that's right.
I know.
I suspect that most folks trust that the information given to them is in full.
Representative Kapoor?
If I'm understanding correctly, this letter, that they did pay the back taxes. They just are trying to get the 25% penalty, so I think that is kind of consistent how we've been making decisions here.
No objection. I just thought, you know, If I can buy gas at a quarter a gallon less, I will find some way to get a card lock permit.
I think we all would.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Representative Loken? Thank you very much for coming in, for bringing
thank
this
you.
Amendment.
One more bill that I will, I think is going to be heard, and I will stay for that one, perhaps.
Okay, sure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question, and I may be the only one on this committee that doesn't know the answer to this, but could you do a little background on what the card lock, I don't even know what it is, except seeing them on the side of the road, but I don't know who can apply or how you get it or any of that.
Who can answer that one? Sure, Dick could or Mr. Hess?
Chairman Strobeck, Representative Corey. I'll try. Card locks are unattended filling stations, and when the used fuel tax law was written back in 1943, I doubt that there were any around. But what it allows is, and we don't regulate it, but it allows certain members of commercial organizations to purchase gasoline and fill their own tanks. Diesel, however, is not, and I know very little about this, I just read something in the law the other day, it's not considered a flammable substance by the state fire marshal's office, who does have some regulatory authority over the card lock, and basically anyone can pump their own diesel. And that's what happened with this particular situation.
But maybe Dick, why don't you, can you just describe the card lock? I mean, card lock.
Is that with diesel then?
No, card locks sell gasoline, but they're generally, you have to have purchase a minimum number of gallons. It's generally done for commercial operations that want to have their trucks fill up and that kind of thing. I did check into them. I mean, I introduced self-serve gas. I don't like sitting around waiting for an attendant, so I checked into that. But you have to buy, I don't know, quite a lot of gallons. I forgot what the number is, but it's a lot of gallons every year in order to qualify and have some sort of a commercial permit and that kind of thing.
I really know very little about it.
Oh. I thought you were the guest clean expert in revenue. That's what it is. It's a way that you can avoid the self-serve law, and you just put the card in, it reads it, you fill up, and then you get a bill at the end of the month for everything that you and wherever those stations are, Pacific Pride, others.
Thank you. I want to thank the committee for helping with this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Wilkie.
Excuse myself.
Sure.
We're getting a little...
Hey, go ahead with your testimony then.
Thank you, Chairman Strobeck. The last, well, sections 14 and 15 of the under the penalty section increase the level of punishment for knowingly and willingly failing to report and pay the use fuel tax from a misdemeanor violation to a Class B felony, the level which currently exists and is consistent with neighboring states. The level of crimes involving failure to pay motor fuel taxes is increasing across the country. However, serious problems in this area are rare in Oregon. The last sections, 16 through 22, give ODOT the authority to deny a license to an individual or a company. Occasionally, licenses have been issued to persons who have a history of motor fuel tax evasion. Other states have enacted legislation that permits the denial of license where the applicant has been convicted of crimes involving motor fuel taxes or in schemes to evade payment. And again, these sections give the agency authority to deny the license.
That seems like a pretty self-evident need. Why hasn't this been done in the past, you know?
I'm really not sure.
It's like giving a firearms violator a gun seller's license.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, I have a couple questions on Section 17, specifically where the language allows the department to refuse to issue a dealer license. The department finds that the person, if you look on line 28 on page 6 of the bill, failed to cooperate with the department's investigation by A, not furnishing requested documents, and then also K, on line 32, failed to comply with an order requested by the department. And then paragraph 2, in addition to refusal of a license for reasons specified, the department may refuse to issue a dealer license for any other reason the department deems sufficient. I guess my concern is there that the language is awfully broad there. And, for example, not furnishing requested documents. What if the request was unlawful or not covered by law, failed to comply with an order issued by the department? What if the order was unlawful? And then, of course, paragraph 2 is a huge catch-all. Basically, you can refuse to issue a license for any reason that the department deems sufficient. Why do you need language that is so broad on those points?
Chairman Strobeck, Representative Witt, you're exactly right. The language is extremely broad. This language, just to give you a little background, came from legislation that was recently enacted in the state of Washington. And the reason why it's so broad is the varying nature of crimes against fuel tax. Different schemes come up all the time. And what this does is give the agency the flexibility to ask for all kinds of information depending on what is considered necessary under the circumstances. And it is very broad. I guess the remedy here is that if someone feels that it's been, that the department has acted incorrectly, there's the hearing process to go through and further appeals.
Mr. Chair. Well, couldn't you accomplish the same purpose, for example, on line 28, if you had not furnishing requested documents that were available to the department under the law and reasonably necessary for the department to conduct its investigation or to do its research?
Chairman Strobeck, Representative Witt, that would be fine. I don't see that would pose a problem.
and in the same way, in line 32, failed to comply with an order issued by the department. It should be a lawful order issued by the department.
I have no problem with that.
Representative Witt, why don't you make some suggestions to Dick, and we'll have some amendments for
you. Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to speak on the ODOT Bill 2190? Seeing no one, close the public hearing. And open the public hearing on House Bill 2901. Representative Witt, why don't you describe where we are with this bill and the amendments that you've prepared?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2901, which we had a public hearing on two or three weeks ago, following that hearing, we had some amendments drafted to the bill. Recall, this is the bill that extends a property tax deferral to low-income disabled individuals in a manner that is similar to the statute that we've had on the books for several years, which provides a deferral to low-income seniors. And during the course of the hearing, I think there were a number of things that came out that led to the drafting of these amendments. And if you want, Mr. Chairman, I'll talk about those amendments specifically.
Yes, please.
Okay, the Dash 1 Amendment specifically says that the disabled person first claiming the deferral for the tax year beginning July 1 may do so by making application as provided for in law on or before December 31, 1999. That way the low-income disabled individual will have an opportunity to get a deferral for the next coming tax year, as the bill previously held that out for another year into the future. The Dash 2 amendments essentially state that if the low-income disabled individual has his or her property taxes deferred, but then the subsequent year is no longer legally disabled or no longer qualifies as being low-income, that they will not be eligible for the deferral in the year in which they are no longer disabled or low-income, and thus they will have to pay their taxes that year. But they can continue to defer the taxes that were deferred during the period of time in which they were qualified under the bill for the deferral. Otherwise, if you had 5 years in which they were low-income disabled, they might have accumulated $10,000 in taxes, for example. And if you take away the deferral at the year that they no longer are qualified and you make it retroactive, they'd have to come up with $10,000 or $12,000 or more to cover their tax bill, or they'd be right back in the situation where they could end up losing their property. So this allows that deferral to stay in place.
And it remains a lien on the property?
Correct. It remains a lien on the property the way it's set up in the bill. And then the Dash 3 amendments raise the income eligibility for the low-income disabled individual in the same manner that I believe was Representative Devlin's bill did it for low-income seniors. So it makes those consistent for both low-income seniors and low-income disabled individuals.
Right. And I should point out that those bills were on the schedule today, but they've been moved till tomorrow. We're submitting for more amendments, so they are related. And the income level?
The income level is adjusted from $24,500 to $27,500. And after the initial deferral, the income can go up in any single year up to $32,000 instead of $29,000. You can still qualify for the deferral.
Okay. And this is the revenue impact statement.
Chairman, I'll go back to the members of the committee. For the revenue impact, all I did was add one additional year due to the change in the Dash 1 amendment. So for the first biennium, it'd be $5.9 million as the amount that would be the cost for the senior deferral program, and then the $6.6 million for the second biennium.
Okay, and this is, again, I think we had some discussion last time we had this up about the calling this loss, because it really is, it's deferred, it's lost maybe for that particular beginning, but it's not lost entirely.
Yeah, I can change that on the final version.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Rudy and Mr. Roach.
Thank you, Representative Grobeck and members of the committee. My name is Tom Rudy. I reside at 6301 Southeast Brownlee Road in Milwaukee, Oregon. I'm here today to support the amendments to this bill as written. I praise Representative Witt and his staff for making these amendments. I've read through them a couple times, and they're very articulately written, and I appreciate the effort that's gone into that. I want to encourage you to push this bill through as quickly as possible. There's a lot of disabled people who own homes who are, for the reasons I stated in my testimony a couple weeks ago, limited in their income. The value of the property is going up at a higher rate than their value, than their cost of living increases, the income they receive. I have experienced that myself. I shared that testimony last time with how it affected me. As high as $12 million back or taxes that are owed, that the tax investor talked about before, that wasn't my property. But I am in a situation where I'm up against the wall, and I would like to continue to live in my home. And if I do reach the point, I have been close in the past, but now I've been able to begin working a little bit and providing more income for myself so I can manage the property taxes that I'm incurring. But if I were to get into that situation again for some reason, if my health deteriorated or if I was unable to continue to grow my employment income, then I might take advantage of this at some point in the future. So from a personal side and as a representative of the disabled in the state who own homes, I appreciate your, like I said, pushing this through and making this legislation available to our citizens.
Okay. Thank you very much. I apologize, but I should have asked Representative Loken to step forward. It's our custom to have representatives speak so that they can get onto the other committee. So join us here, Representative Loken.
We both live in the same town here. So.
Okay.
Representative Loken, District 25, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2901. I've heard three amendments suggested and would like to also suggest another amendment. I have worked for some time over since I've been in the session with helping advance the benefits from the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program, and was able 2 terms ago to get the cap raised, and I see that there's some more progress with that, and I'm really pleased to see that. I have also all along felt that there should be a little more consideration given in the interest rate. The current rate is 6%, and I would like to see that dropped. My amendment that I have before you today, I think you have it before you, is 2%. I realize that is a considerable drop. There will be a financial impact. However, as we consider the wish and the concern for seniors and for the disabled to remain in their homes and to not see their equity disappear too rapidly, and that is a concern. I realize that this is a generous bill and that it allows people to defer their property tax as long as they're in the home and they don't sell it. But, you know, we all are concerned if the equity reduces. And so this is one attempt to keep that equity intact and allow those who are availing themselves of this opportunity to have a little more, be more at ease about using this program. I would like to see more seniors and disabled be able to use the program so that they are able to stay in their home. And at this time, as I have talked to people about it, there is a concern. They say, but our equity is lost. We don't want to be in debt and so on. But I feel the state has a right to a lien on that property, but I would like to see the equity not decrease and be impacted as rapidly as it is today. Also, we have seen interest rates drop considerably over the past 4 or 5 years. And I think that this could be reflected also in this bill. So I am proposing 2%, but that's flexible, and I'd appreciate your consideration of an appropriate deduction from the 6% rate.
Thank you, Representative Wilkin.
Representative Merkley. Thank you, Representative. I have a distant memory from back when this program was first created, that it had a very low interest rate of perhaps a 1% or 2% interest rate. Are you familiar with that legislative history?
Not to that extent. No, I am not. Mm-hmm. But it was intended, I believe, to an attempt for the state to recoup whatever the administrative expenses were in administering the program, and I think this, the 6% more than aptly does that now.
I'll try to check on that legislative history because this was long before. This was a long time ago. But what I recall is, and this is vague, so I may be confusing it with some other program, mm-hmm. was that the problem that was created was that it really became financially smart for people who had no particular need to defer their taxes, to defer them because they could put their money in the bank, earn somewhere 3, 4, 5% interest while paying 1 to 2% interest, and I think that's what led to it being raised. I'm not sure of this, but I'll check on that. But if indeed that's the legislative history, I'd want to look and examine what the problem was before determining whether or not we should return to that low interest rate.
Well, certainly I'd be interested in knowing that too. But the people I have talked to are lower income, and they don't have a lot of money to invest in the bank or in investment securities and so on. So I don't find, in talking to people, that this is the motive behind their using this. In fact, they're hesitant to use it. That's why we have a few using it.
Okay, any other questions on this amendment? Thank you, Representative Wilkin.
Thank you. Appreciate an opportunity to come before you.
Roach.
Thank you, Representative Strobeck and the committee. I appreciate you hearing this bill with its changes. A couple of thoughts. With some previous testimony, I've talked to several people as I've been out trying to do a few things, who have really have a need for this bill. It's interesting when you talk to someone, they know someone that could help, or they know of someone that wish it had been in place when they were going through a very difficult time. So I find it interesting that people are concerned and interested when they find out that something could be done to help them. And it's specifically two people that I know very well from past experience. With the representative that just left, I would have to agree with her. For low-income people, we don't have the money to do a whole lot of investment, even though it might sound dollar smart to put the money in another investment. We're just struggling to try to keep where we're at. And as for myself, the concern of having equity erode is a concern, too, because I would like to be able to leave my children something, and that's about all I really have left to leave them is the house that they've been in. I guess I forgot to state for the record, my name is John Roach. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon, so I'll do that now. One other concern I have would be for a person which is having to go through the disability process. It takes time to go through that, and for example, the person I was talking about earlier, her sister is going through this process. She has some major health problems. This bill would help her, particularly the lady at the bank where I go, who's the manager. This is her sister. And if there was some way that when a person is applied for disability, that if a notice can be given to the tax department, so there's not heavy economic pressure at that time, or if the interest rate is lowered, it could be lowered at that particular rate in the time of application. That might be a consideration for the panel here to think about. But I thank you again for your effort and from Mr. Witt's office and the cooperation of the people and the bipartisan support for this bill, and I believe the people that really need it would very, very appreciate it very much if they understood what was happening here today. I thank you for your time.
Okay, well, we thank both of you for the time and interest you've shown and the repeat visits and those kinds of things. Is there something else, Mr. Rubin?
Yes, sir. Representative Kovac, members of the committee. I'd just like to comment briefly, if I may, about Representative Loken's comment and then Representative Merkley's question to her. I, too, have thought about the interest rate and pondered it to some extent in my own mind. I feel that the set rate that is set right now is a little high because the prevailing interest rates are much lower than they were when that bill was originally created. My suggestion would be to maybe just insert one line to have that interest rate tied in some way to the prevailing interest rate for that year that the taxes are deferred, so that the interest rate paid would perhaps be more accurately tied to the current interest rate. So that I think that would ameliorate the problem that Representative Merkley alluded to, that the person in the home might be tempted to invest any money they might have at a higher rate than what it would be if they were paying their taxes. Okay. Thank you.
I would, can I say one more thing?
Sure.
If that is something that needs to be put in, it might be well to have at least an interest rate ceiling cap. Because I certainly remember the days of the Jimmy Carter administration, and it would destroy a lot real fast if there wasn't. So I appreciate your consideration on that.
All right. Thank you both very much. Any questions for these witnesses?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. This bill is really a tribute to the effort and the interest that these gentlemen have shown in this. And in the first week of the session, Mr. Roach called me and alerted me to this problem. And Mr. Rudy got involved, and it was frankly their persistence and hard work here that's hopefully going to bring this about. So I appreciated the efforts that both of you have shown throughout this.
Mr. Oregon?
For the record, my name is Eugene Oregon. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Disabilities Commission, and I'm here today in support of the bill, which Mr. Rudy and Mr. Burke spoke of. This bill was actually brought up to you 2 years ago in this session. Mr. Rudy has been working on this for that long, and he's gotten this far. I think it is a credit to him and his persistence. He's been able to see this legislation through to hearing, hopefully to the floor. I think this bill particularly speaks to the need for independence for people with disabilities. Those folks who are low income, most people with disabilities are low income. 70%+ of us are unemployed, which speaks to me for a low income, a low threshold of revenue available to us. I think that this bill, however, allows those individuals who do happen to own a home for whatever reason to be able to remain within that home and to be able to live their lives as independently as possible. That's long been one of the core values that our commission has been working towards. It's one of the measuring sticks by which we measure legislation and other programs. Does the promote independence? I think this bill does. I think that it's not going to be extremely costly. I rather suspect that the people with disabilities who own their home tend to be people who have acquired a disability later in life, who have an injury which results in a disability, and they've been able to accrue some income or to purchase a home. I frankly think it will help out some people very much, and for that reason, we are very supportive of the bill and encourage this passage.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Thanks a lot. Is there anyone else to speak on this bill, 2901? If not, close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2901 and consider moving the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2109.
Representative Rasmussen moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2901. Is there any discussion on that? I should point out that the -1s are in conflict with the -4, so if we adopt the -1s, we'll not be able to adopt the -4, so we might want to have a discussion about that. Any chooses? Okay, seeing none. Is there any objection to the -1? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move adoption of the -2s to House Bill 2901.
Representative Rasmussen moves adoption of the -2 amendments to House Bill 2901. So any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move adoption of the -3 amendments to House Bill 2901.
Representative Rasmussen moves adoption of the -3 amendments to House Bill 2901. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move House Bill 2901 to the floor with the due, as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 2901 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Short.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Ketterly.
Aye.
Representative
Wells?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Director Rasmussen?
Aye.
Chair
Strobeck? Aye. House Bill 2-1 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Witt, would you like to carry that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
As well as Representative Kafoury is a co-sponsor as well.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, close the work session on House Bill 2901.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I was a little bit confused. Is that a co-carry that they would both be carrying the bill?
I didn't indicate that. I know we do that sometimes, but
I'll just type it.
Mover on it. I was just encouraging Representative Kafoury to be supportive on the floor.
I'm certain that Representative Kafoury has always been supportive on the floor.
There we go.
Mr. Chair, I know there's no testimony in opposition to this bill. Should we be concerned about a veto?
If it only gets 2 negative votes on the floor, I'd be very concerned. Hey, no further business. We're adjourned.